Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bruce Katz.
Welcome everyone this morning. I want to thank Strobe for his earlier introduction. I also want to thank Dr. Ackerman for the support of this summit and for his compelling vision of green growth. And thank all of you for coming here today. So about 2 years ago, almost to the day, I visited a group of small suburban municipalities to see firsthand the impact of the housing crisis and the economic downturn. And what I saw, which won't be surprising to people in this room, was stark. Foreclosed homes, abandoned properties, boarded up stores, empty spaces. Where did I visit? Chicago's inner suburbs. Riverdale, Harvey, Blue Island, Crestwood, literally about 30 minutes from where we sit today. What I witnessed was not an isolated case. It was a microcosm of the failed economy and failed economic policy that has deeply touched the lives of tens of millions of Americans during this Great Recession. We had an economy and we had an economic policy which elevated consumption over production, financial chicanery over real innovation, and short-term speculation over long-term growth. And we lost our way in the United States, and frankly, we got the economy and the recession we deserved. The devastation I saw in Chicago suburbs will not fundamentally change until we chart a different course for our country. And today I'm going to make the following proposition. First, we must shape a different kind of economy, a next economy that is driven by exports, powered by low carbon, fueled by innovation, and rich with opportunity. This is a vision where we export more, we waste less, we innovate in what matters, we produce and deploy more of what we invent, and we ensure that the economy actually works for working families. Second, the next economy will be largely metropolitan in form and in function. Our major metro areas in this country generate nearly 3/4 of our gross domestic product. We may be nostalgic about small-town America, but it is metropolitan America that drives our national economy and determines our national prosperity. Finally, it is time to build the next economy by unleashing the entrepreneurial energies and dynamism of our metro engines. Now, in an ideal world, the federal government would set a strong platform for metro growth. They would embrace trade, they would price carbon, they would invest at scale in advanced research and development, they would transform infrastructure, they would overhaul immigration. But the United States circa 2010 is not the ideal world. Ideologues rule our airwaves. Washington is fundamentally broken, and most states are broke. So we're going to build the next economy the hard way, through a pragmatic caucus of public, nonprofit, and civic leaders who spur economic recovery and renewal from the ground up, despite political odds and fiscal obstacles. Make no mistake, the stakes are very high and the urgency to act is very real, but other nations are moving with deliberation and discipline to exploit the full potential of their metro engines. So we can and we must do the same. So let me begin by offering a vision for the next American economy. And let's begin with exports and our need to fully engage the world. Visualize an economy where more firms in more sectors trade more goods and services seamlessly with the world, particularly with nations that are rapidly urbanizing and industrializing. Why exports? Because we have crossed an economic Rubicon. Together, Brazil, India, and China, the BRICS, are expected to account for about a fifth of global GDP in 2010, surpassing the United States for the first time. By 2015, the BIC share will grow to more than 25%. The rise of the BICs reflects the rise of metros. For the first time in recorded history, more than half of the world's population lives in cities and metropolitan areas. And by 2030, the metro share will grow to 60%. Rising nations and their rapidly growing metros now power the world economy and drive global demand. The locus of economic power in the world is shifting. The top 30 metro performers in the last year are almost exclusively located in Asia and Latin America. The 30 worst metro performers are nearly all located in Europe and the United States. The U.S. needs to reorient our economy to take advantage of this global demand. In 2008, exports made up only 13% of the GDP of the United States, compared to 36% in China, 35% in Canada, and much higher levels in India, Japan, and the entire EU. The movement of freight in the United States is compromised, undermined by transport networks that are clogged and congested, and an infrastructure that everyone in this room knows is third class. And culturally, Americans don't get out much. Only about 28% of our citizens have a passport. So can we get back into the export game? We think the answer is decidedly yes. We still manufacture a range of advanced goods that the rest of the world wants. Spacecraft, aircraft, electrical machinery, high-precision surgical instruments, high-quality pharmaceutical products. We already have a trade surplus in services, $152 billion in 2008, and we're poised for a quantum leap in the export of high-value services. America's potential for exports is hidden in plain sight, and President Obama's challenge to double exports in 5 years is exactly the kind of ambitious, far-reaching challenge we need at this moment. Now, low carbon is the second hallmark of the next U.S. economy. So let's imagine a world where America is the vanguard of the clean green revolution, or as Dr. Ackerman has suggested, the second industrial revolution. Everything is about to change. The energy we use will migrate from an almost exclusive focus on carbon-based fuels to a more sustainable mix. The infrastructure we build will shift from outmoded transported energy to systems that are smarter and faster and technologically enabled. The products we buy will move from high-carbon gas guzzlers to an eclectic basket of green, sustainable goods. And the homes we live in and the office and retail buildings we frequent will be more sustainable in design, more efficient in their use of water and energy, and better arrayed so we can walk more, spend less, and live a higher quality of life. Our competitors, China, Germany, Brazil, have embraced the green economy. They are creating markets, they are growing jobs, they are stimulating investment. China is hell bent on being the world's green producer, and they are out-investing us on renewable energy and high-speed rail and a host of other sustainable interventions. Can the U.S. even play in the low-carbon revolution? Our research shows that we already have a strong base of more than 2 million green jobs in sectors ranging from renewable energy to pollution reduction. No other nation can match us in domestic demand, advanced research, venture capital, and entrepreneurial dynamism. It is time for us to fully engage the shift to low carbon and leapfrog other nations on a market transformation as profound as the information revolution. That leads naturally to a discussion of innovation. The U.S. must be the world's innovation nation, a hothouse not just of ideas and inventions, but in a platform for advanced production. I believe we're on the cusp of an historic era of technological progress, of technological acceleration, which will dramatically change how people live, companies operate, and communities function. I think this could be our future. Trust me, there were other clips I wanted to show, but okay, maybe we won't have that much innovation, at least this century. But self-driving vehicles, smart homes, remote monitoring of health, the future is coming soon, and in some cases, is already here. These technologies are not just cool stuff. They will change lives, they will save lives, they will drive investment, they will create jobs, and they will transform economies. Can the U.S. seize the future and be the world's innovation nation? We now place just 45th out of 93 countries in the share that science and engineering degrees make up of bachelor's degrees. Going forward, we will innovate less if we do not embrace fully science and technology. The U.S. lags on the conversion of innovation into homegrown production. We have gone from running a trade surplus in advanced technology products to running a trade deficit over the past decade. Going forward, we will innovate less if we do not produce more. We must make things again in the United States. It is time to rediscover our innovation mojo. In our vocational and tech schools, on our factory floors, in the tradable goods and service sectors that drive wealth creation and sustainable growth. Now, finally, the next economy does have the potential to be opportunity rich. Research shows that firms in export-intense industries pay workers higher wages and are more likely to provide health and retirement benefits. A low-carbon economy, as Dr. Ackerman has suggested, could be an engine for job creation, delivered by millions of new workers across a range of professions and occupations. And innovation has always been the historic catalyst and fuel for economic growth. All of this is going to require the United States to get real smart, real fast. Over the next several decades, African Americans and Hispanics will grow from about 25% to nearly 40% of our working age population. Yet the rates of educational attainment are lowest among these fast-growing groups. In 2008, only 13% of Hispanics, only 18% of African Americans had a bachelor's degree. And that contrasts sharply with the educational attainment figures for whites and Asians. In the decades ahead, upgrading the education and skills of our diverse workforce is no longer just a matter of social equity. It is fundamentally an issue of national competitiveness and national security. Here's my second proposition. The next economy will be largely metropolitan in form and in function. This is true abroad, as I mentioned before. It is absolutely true here in the United States. This is the real heart of the American economy. 100 metropolitan areas that, after decades of growth, constitute only 12% of our land mass, but house two-thirds of our population and generate three-quarters of our gross domestic product. These metros form a new economic geography, seamlessly enveloping cities and suburbs, exurbs, and rural towns, and they pack a powerful punch. Chicagoland is home to 67% of the population of the state, but you contribute 78% of your state's GDP. Greater Seattle, 51% of the state of Washington, but 69% of the economic output of that state. And metro areas generate the majority of GDP in 47 of the 50 states, including such rural states as Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Arkansas. Bottom line, there is no national American economy. Rather, the U.S. economy is a network of powerful metropolitan economies, and metropolitan economies are powerful precisely because they bring together networks of large firms, small entrepreneurs, skilled labor, advanced research, colleges and schools, business associations, and yes, government. Top 100 metros together dominate our trade in goods and services. And given their edge in sectors like chemicals, computers, and consulting, they're on the front lines of commerce with Brazil, India, and China. The nation's four largest exporting metros, New York, LA, Chicago, Houston, super-sized performers, exporting more than $50 billion apiece in 2008. Other major metros, Dallas, San Francisco, Boston, Philly, Detroit, Seattle, they're also global players, exporting more than $24 billion apiece in 2008. Incredibly, these 10 large metros generated close to 30% of national exports in 2008. It's not just about the large metros. As we see here, these 10 medium-sized metros are dependent on exports in ways that larger metros are not. Exports contribute more than 15% of gross metropolitan product in these economies. Top 100 metros dominate exports for another good reason. There are logistical hubs. They concentrate the movement of people and goods by air, rail, and sea. Beyond exports, the top metros dominate critical sectors of the low-carbon economy. Supermajority of the jobs, solar energy, wind energy, energy research, engineering, and consulting, and they harbor 85% of jobs in green architecture, design, and construction. But since making buildings energy efficient is largely a metropolitan act, because that's where most people live and buildings are located. And on innovation more broadly, our major metros are the nation's knowledge centers. They gather our most educated citizens, they produce the bulk of our patents, they receive the lion's share of NIH and NSF funding, and they provide almost all of the venture capital that turns research ideas into production. In short, the next economy will be shaped, determined, and delivered by metropolitan America. So that leads naturally to the final proposition. If we're going to build this next economy, the United States must unleash the entrepreneurial energies and dynamism of our metropolitan engines. We compete in a fiercely competitive world. Established nations like Germany, rising nations like China, India, and Brazil are making transformative investments in modern ports, in renewable energy, in high-speed rail, in advanced research institutions, in the precise places, Munich and Shanghai and Mumbai and Sao Paulo, that drive their national economies. We must do the same. To boost exports, we need a next generation of infrastructure to seamlessly connect firms and places within the nation and to markets abroad. To lead the green revolution, we must invest in advanced R&D to crack the code on low carbon and spur technological progress. To stimulate innovation, we need advanced manufacturing right here at home so that the U.S. does not outsource the production of every idea we generate. And to ensure opportunity, we must arm our people with the education and skills necessary to compete globally. Each one of these moves to rebalance the metro economy must run through our metros if we're going to maximize the returns for people, for firms, and for investors. For the United States, the question is not what to do, but how to do it. We all know the conventional wisdom. The parties are too divided between blue and red for anything of import to happen over the next several years. That's why I wore a purple shirt. I beg to differ. I contend that those of us in this room and the sectors and constituencies and jurisdictions we represent can be the adult leadership that America desperately needs. We form America's natural pragmatic caucus, close to ground, hungry for results, prizing place over party, solution over dogma, collaboration over conflict. Here is what I contend we do the next several years together to spur economic recovery and renewal. First, let's help each American metro exploit its distinctive competitive edge in the global market. The prior consumption economy minimized the difference between metros. Communities followed a uniform Starbucks and Stadia recipe, irrespective of market condition or location. The next economy, by contrast, accentuates what's unique about different metros. Raleigh specializes in life sciences, Charlotte finance, Atlanta transport production. The next economy rewards metros, which intentionally build from their special assets and strengthen their distinctive strengths. The prior economy also lacked any fiscal discipline. Cities and suburbs competed to literally move businesses a few miles across artificial political borders. The next economy, by contrast, rewards cities and suburbs that collaborate to compete rather than compete against each other. That's what Mayor Daley has done here with your Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus. That's what Mayor Nutter is doing in Philadelphia with his Metro Caucus. Collaboration must now be the norm, not the exception. You will hear later from leaders in two European metros, Turin and Barcelona, who have embraced intelligent economic design and purposeful action. You will also hear from leaders in Northeast Ohio, a combination of Cleveland and Akron and Youngstown, Minneapolis-St. Paul, and the Puget Sound region, who are working with Brookings to produce what we call metropolitan business plans. Each plan outlines a detailed initiative tailored to the special assets and challenges of their disparate places. Retooling manufacturing firms and retraining industrial workers in Northeast Ohio. Spurring entrepreneurial activity and the commercialization of innovation in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And becoming a global hub of advanced green technologies in greater Seattle. These business plans are low cost, but high impact. They are primed and they will attract public and private investment, produce jobs in the near term, and retool economies for the long haul. So imagine if 7 or 10 or 15 or 25 metros follow this intentional path in the next several years. We can literally change and redefine the shape of the U.S. economy from the ground up. Now, our second act naturally follows from the first. Let's bend state actions to metro vision. In a month, 37 newly elected or reelected governors will take office in tough times. They inherit unemployment levels that are unacceptably high, budget shortfalls of historic scale. They will need to grow jobs while making harsh cuts. I urge metros to join Brookings and challenge states. To grow jobs, align state resources to metropolitan priorities. What if Ohio placed its economic and workforce policies in the service of Northeast Ohio's plan to retool manufacturing? What if Minnesota fully leveraged the entrepreneurial potential of Minneapolis and St. Paul? And what if the state of Washington got completely behind Seattle's creative plan for green growth? Any successful corporation knows to reward departments and divisions that are strategic and focused and disciplined in execution. States must do the same with their creative metro. To grow jobs, govern for growth. This metropolis is awash in municipalities, school districts, and special authorities. In fact, most states have designed local governments for the 18th century rather than the 21st. Fragmentation duplicates spending. Balkanization undermines global competitiveness. To new governors, this is the moment to radically reshape the structure of local government. To grow the next economy, invest smart. That's exactly what voters in Ohio did earlier this year when they approved by a 62-38 margin a $700 million bond issue for their state's proven Third Frontier Fund, which invests in promising energy and technology startups. Ohio's voters understood that America cannot cut our way to growth. Just imagine if every state offered their voters an opportunity to support market-shaping investments tailored to their own metro strengths. Perhaps clean energy in Colorado or transformative infrastructure in California or advanced manufacturing in Michigan. So that leads to the final step. Let's finally place the federal government in the service of metropolitan growth. For the foreseeable future, the federal government will be excessively partisan and deeply polarized, but it will not be paralyzed. Even in the most divisive times, work gets done. 1995 produced public housing transformation. 1996 yielded welfare reform. 1997, a balanced budget agreement. Along those lines, Brookings and Metros can engage the federal government strategically. As with states, align federal resources to help those metros that help themselves. Take the 3010 initiative in LA. 2 years ago, in the middle of the recession, LA voters approved a sales tax to build a state-of-the-art metro transit system in 30 years. Mayor Villaraigosa, who we'll hear from later, has offered the federal government a brilliant plan. Give LA low-cost federal credit backed by sales tax revenues, and LA will finish the job in just 10 years. Accelerating construction would create 160,000 jobs in a metro where 750,000 people are currently unemployed. This is the new kind of bottom-up federalism for the United States, which can be repeated across the country as metros innovate not just on infrastructure, but on other economy-building moves like export promotion, clean energy, and education reform. As with states, govern for growth. Washington is a legacy government with bureaucracies designed for a different era and a different economy. We now need more nimble, more market-oriented institutions to unleash private capital and make investment decisions based on merit and evidence rather than politics. A national infrastructure bank can do that for our ports and rail networks. A national green bank can do that to spur a low-carbon economy. Private capital and private entrepreneurs are sitting on the sidelines ready to be deployed by smart action. As with states, invest smart. The federal tax code is replete with expenditures that actually fuel consumption rather than incentives that catalyze production. The worst offender by far, the federal mortgage interest deduction. It's scheduled amazingly to grow steadily over the next 5 years. The single act of capping this deduction at current levels would save $177 billion during this 5-year period, more than enough to contribute to deficit reduction and finance every market-shaping solution we've discussed today. The President's Commission on Deficit Reduction and other deficit reduction panels have already put the mortgage interest deduction on the table. Will Metro leaders weigh in to build a more productive, sustainable, and inclusive economy? Here's the bottom line. Decisions on the national deficit or national economic policy are not above the pay grade of Metro America. It is time for metros to act like the engines of national prosperity they are. All nations know that metros are too big to fail economically. If organized, they are too big to ignore politically. So let me end where I began, in the southern suburbs of Chicago. For these communities, the past does not need to be prologue. These places can be hubs of advanced manufacturing, they can be transit-oriented centers for living and work, and they can be clean and green, diverse and inclusive. We can build a different future for these communities and compete globally as a nation if we restructure our economy towards exports and low carbon in favor of innovation fueled by education and skills. This is the path back to prosperity for the United States, and it's a path that runs directly through metropolitan America. So the people in this room, you embody the energy and the potential of metropolitan areas. I urge you to leave today and act with purpose. Set a vision for growth in your areas that is intentional. Align federal, state, private philanthropic investments to that vision. Organize politically, and use that muscle to drive systemic reforms and transformative investments at the state and federal level. I challenge you, in short, to act like a pragmatic caucus across sectors, disciplines, jurisdictions, and yes, even political parties. If you do these things, guarantee Jobs will follow, investment will flow, innovation will spread like wildfire across this country. You are the distinctive, grounded voice in the debate that's coming over jobs and taxes and the economy and investment. Let that voice be heard in action and innovation, but also advocacy. We are a metro nation in a metro world, and it is high time we started acting like that. Thank you very much.